are back again this week as we're following the life of Jesus through the biography of Mark, something that Harley and I have been learning from a mentor, and we're trying to pass along as accurately as we possibly can. And this week, specifically, what we're going to be talking about, we're going to kind of sit down in a topic that I think is common among all people. Okay, I think that what we're talking about this morning is something that people from all walks of life, all time periods, all cultures, all languages would agree with. There have been books written, research done, lectures given, all centering around humanity's search for meaning, right? Meaning. All revolving around humanity's search for purpose, meaning, truth, identity, and so on and so forth. All of it. I mean, we're trying to get the answers to these really big questions and to better understand why are we here? What is the point? What is the purpose? And all of that, all of those questions are kind of wrapped in a human condition, something that all of us share. We may not think about it in those terms, but we all share this. And that is every single person in this room and watching online, we all agree with this statement. We all want to be happy, right? We all want to be happy. I mean, even the person that you look at and you think, well, man, they've kind of got that Eeyore attitude. You know, the Eeyore, Winnie the Pooh, Eeyore, right? They got that. They're just always so sullen. Hey, even that person wants to be happy. Now, they're seeking happiness. We're all in this process. This is a human condition. It's true of all people groups, all cultures, all time periods. We're all searching for happiness. We could call it satisfaction. We could call it contentment. A lot of different words that we could use to describe this, but we're all kind of looking for that. And we're all looking in different ways, right? You're looking differently than I am, and I'm looking differently than you are, but we've all searched for it. And some of you think you found it. Some of you would say, yeah, I think I've found it. I think I've found the answer to that age-old human question. Some of you thought you found it. You kind of thought you had found it, and you're not sure anymore. And some of you would have to say, I don't think I've ever found it. I honestly don't think, I don't even know that it's possible to be happy. Let me give you a few examples, just a few among the dozens of ways that humanity has searched for happiness for millennia. Some of us, and this may be you, some of us have searched in what we're going to call this morning secularism or hedonism. And that's basically just the stuff that we do to bring pleasure. The things that we go after, the activities that we want to be involved in for the purpose of bringing pleasure. And then it brings pleasure, and so we want to do it again because we like that and we want to experience that pleasure again. Didn't necessarily result in happiness, you know, not real, true happiness, but it produced pleasure, and that's kind of the next best thing. But then, maybe for you, what you realized, if that was you, and if that's kind of the way that you were trying to answer that age-old human question, can I be happy, purpose, all of that, you kind of realized that you were on this hedonic treadmill, right? You kind of realized where you became addicted to that pleasure and you're never really satisfied. And so once that high wears off, you're trying to get it again and again. And you're just on this up and down roller coaster, treadmill, however you want to call it. And in spite of the cycle, in spite of spending a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of your resources to do these things, you're still not all that happy. You're just in this cycle. And that really describes a lot of our community, a lot of our culture today. In spite of like record consumerism, you know, we've got more disposable income than ever. And in spite of that, our culture is still largely unhappy, which really recently that should come as no surprise. And here's why. Because recent studies, and we're talking over the last several decades, recent studies have shown that really the best way to reach that point of contentment, security, happiness, whatever you want to call it, is actually to do acts of selfless kindness. Selfless kindness. That's kind of what psychology will tell you. If you were to go to any counselor worth their salt, that's something akin to what they're going to tell you. If you're depressed or if you're struggling with this, struggling with that, and I'm not trying to, you know, like minimize any of that or nothing along those lines, but what they're going to probably land on is they're going to say, hey, you need to get out and do something for someone else, not just yourself. And if you do enough of that, if you do enough for other people where you don't really get anything out of it, then you will be happy. You will no longer be depressed. You will, whatever. You'll be okay. So we try that. Maybe you've done that. Maybe you've tried that. Maybe you've had that conversation. You go out and you mow a yard for no pay, you know. You take somebody to a doctor's appointment or whatever it is for you. And I'll be the first one to tell you, it does make you feel pretty good. It does. It feels good. There's nothing wrong with a well-placed pat on the back, you know, self-placed pat on the back. I like a good attaboy as much as the next person. It does make you feel good. It does make you feel like you've done something. But still, that doesn't do it. Not consistently, you know? And so it's like, okay, so I can't do that. That's not really getting me where it is that I think I need to go. And so I'll just try to be really good. I'll try to follow the rules. I'll try to be a moral person. I'll try to stay inside of the guardrails, you know? I'll try to check the proper boxes because that's what somebody told me. Somebody told me, maybe in a place just like this, by the way, someone told me that if you're good enough, eventually the good will kind of come back to you, right? This is the way it was taught to me. What goes around comes around, right? What goes around comes around. If you just keep at it and you just do right, you just do good, you follow the rules, you're a kind, selfless person, eventually you're going to get some of that back. That is a very rudimentary description of moralism. It's not right down, it's pretty close. That's moralism. Or maybe you came from a religious background, right? Maybe you grew up like me. You kind of grew up in church. You grew up with this concept of an absolute authority, and that absolute authority has some rules, has some expectations, has some do's and some don'ts. And so you decided that in order to be happy, what you needed to do was to earn credit or earn points so that you can receive things from God, right? You kind of wanted to stack up those God points. And if you stacked up enough of those God points, well, then you'd be doing okay and you'd be satisfied, you'd be happy. And just, let's be honest, somewhere in the back of all of our minds, deep down, we can't get away from that feeling that, well, maybe that's what I've got to do. I've got to be good enough so that I can, you know, meet the standard and get into heaven when I die, right? That's religion. That's religion. That's just an example. That's just another way to describe religion. And so basically what I've just described is humanity on and on and on, day after day, year after year, decade after decade, millennia after millennia, just trying to be happy, just trying to measure up. You're just trying to be enough. You're just trying to be satisfied. You're just trying to go to bed at the end of the night and lay down and go, I'm okay. I'm okay. And you know this, all of the stuff that was on that screen, all of that stuff, all of it, it's not going to do it. It hasn't done it. Maybe for a short period of time, but it didn't do it. Not really. And here's the reason why. Because of all that secularism, hedonism, psychology, moralism, religion, and we could go on and on and on. But here's the reason. Here's the reason that really doesn't get it done. Because all of it, if we track it down, all of those things, if we were to track those things down to their original source, it's still all about you. Think about it. It's all about you. It's living a selfless life in order for you and me to be happy, not because we ought to, not because, you know, living a moral life because it's not living a moral life because it's the moral thing to do. Doing it is actually not all that selfless. It's actually very selfish. Think about it. When we try to live this selfless life so that we can be happy, we're just doing it for ourselves. Everything is about me. Ultimately, I'm doing it for me, not for you. I'm doing what I'm doing for you so that in the long run, when it all comes out in the wash, I'm going to be happy. I'm going to be satisfied. I'm going to be okay. And I know you're like, okay, I kind of see your point. I'm not sure that I totally agree, but I kind of see your point. So what are we going to do about that? What do you do? Where does that leave us as humanity? How can we be truly happy, truly satisfied, truly content? Because that's what you want. That's what I want. That's what humanity has desired for millennia. This is a part of the human condition. So how do we truly become unselfish people? Secularism won't do it. Hedonism won't do it. Psychology can't get you there. Religion, moralism, that's not the ticket. What's the ticket? How do you do it? It's kind of what we're talking about today. All of that was like an introduction, sorry. But that's kind of what we're talking about today, because the ticket is actually an entirely different way of thinking. It is an entirely different way of living, and it is a brand new way of just being. It's a brand new way of looking at this. And that's where we're beginning today, and I promise you, we're going to get back to this, okay? That part right there, we're going to get back there. But before we get back there, I've got to kind of hit you with the whiplash statement. So bear with me, grab onto your armrests. I need to hit you with the whiplash statement, and that is this. There is no doubt that Jesus came to die. That's his purpose. There's no doubt. Like I said, it's a whiplash statement. It seems to have absolutely no connection to what we've been talking about. Bad transition. Bad. Jesus, thank you, Mom. Sensible chuckle. I appreciate that. That helped. Jesus came to die. That was the point. That was his purpose. Now, on this side of the cross, right, you know, 2,000 years later, with all of the context that we have because of eyewitnesses like Matthew and Peter and John and people like Luke and Mark and people like James and Paul and all of the context that Scripture gives us, we know that on this side of the cross because we read what Jesus did, what he said, and Jesus himself makes it very, very clear that was his purpose. I grew up with that. You grew up with that. But for the disciples, they didn't. And we say this a whole lot around here, maybe too often, but for the disciples on that side of the cross, that wasn't all that clear to them. Or at the very least, it wasn't computing for them that he came, the king came to die. Even though by the time that it got to the point that we're at in Mark's biography, Peter's biography, Jesus has very, very clearly told them two different times that was the point. Very clearly, he said in Mark chapter 8, he teaches them that the Son of Man must suffer many things, must be rejected by the elders, and will be killed, but on the third day will rise again. Even though Jesus said it, and then Peter specifically says, he spoke plainly about this. He didn't hide it from them. This wasn't a parable, no analogy, no metaphor, straightforward. Here is why I'm here. Suffer, rejected, and killed. And again, one chapter later, Jesus tells them, according to Mark in Mark chapter 9, they left that place, passed through Galilee. Jesus didn't want anybody to know where he was because he was teaching his disciples. And he told them straightforward, the Son of Man, that's Jesus. He's going to be delivered into the hands of men and they're going to kill him. I am going to die. It's going to happen. I'm going to be rejected by the Jewish leaders. I'm going to be delivered into the hands of Gentiles and I am going to be killed. And then, just in case they were missing it, which apparently they still were, or they were not allowing their minds to go here because this was so crazy. How is the king going to be rejected and killed? Just in case, he's going to repeat himself a third time. A third time. This is in Mark chapter 10. They're on their way to Jerusalem. So this is actually, they are on their way to Jerusalem for him to fulfill his purpose. This is the lead up. This is going from Galilee in the north to Jerusalem in the south. Jesus is walking ahead of them. The disciples are filled with awe. The people following behind are overwhelmed with fear. That's interesting, but we don't have time. And then apparently Jesus takes his 12 disciples aside. He like pulls them off to the side of the road. And once more, according to Mark, according to Peter, who was there, he tells his disciples everything that was getting ready to happen. And with this specific account, he gives a little bit more detail. We have more facts. We have more information to flesh it out. And Jesus says to his guys on the side of the road, on the way to Jerusalem, listen, fellas, we're going to Jerusalem where the Son of Man will be betrayed to the leading priests and the teachers of religious law. They are going to sentence me to die. They are going to hand me over to the Romans. The Romans are then going to mock me, they're going to spit on me, they're going to flog me with the whip, and they are going to kill me. But after 3 days, I'm going to rise again. So, third time, Jesus gives more information. Because Jews and Gentiles, Jews and the Romans are going to be involved in this as well. And it's very, very clear that this is more than just a rejection. This is more than just kind of a random thing. a side piece to the story. No, no, no. Jesus says, I'm going to be condemned to death, meaning that this will be a legal matter. I am going to be tried. I am going to be executed within the criminal justice system of the Roman Empire. That's what's getting ready to happen. And the third time, he gives a much more graphic detail. He says, they're going to mock me. They're going to spit on me. They're going to flog me. It's going to be terrible. Because his death is not a side piece to the mission. His death is central to his identity. It is central to his purpose on earth. Jesus came to die. And not only that, the big news isn't just that Jesus will die. It is why he's going to die. Mark 10, verse 45, same conversation. On the way to Jerusalem, side of the road, pulls the guys together. He says, for even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve others. And the way he's going to serve others, Jesus' words, not mine, Jesus says, is to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus came not to be served, but to die and to give his life as a ransom for me. So here's the point. All of that, here's the point. Every other religion, and you know there's a lot of them out there, a lot of options. You've got many choices when it comes to religion, right? Every other religion that's out there, every other belief system that's out there, all of them, every other avenue that humanity has kind of landed on to try to move toward happiness, to try to find fulfillment, purpose, to get the answers to those questions that we all have. We don't talk about them. I don't tell you my questions and you don't tell me your questions, but we all kind of have the same questions. What humanity has landed on to find the answers to those questions, in every other religious system, every other belief system, the leader of the system, the focus of the system, they lived for the purpose of being an example. That was the point. They lived for the purpose of being an example and for their teaching and for their example and all of that to be emulated and to be learned from and to do better and to kind of be able to, you know, do your best. Christianity's different. It's different. That's not what Christianity teaches about Jesus's purpose. Christianity is the only religion that makes the claim that it makes. And again, and we say this a lot with this series, but I think it's important for you to understand, whether you believe it or not, whether you're watching online and you're like, man, I think Christianity's false. Whether you believe it or not, I'm just telling you what Christianity teaches. I'm just telling you that I think Christianity kind of has the best explanation for all of the questions that humanity seems to have. Because Christianity teaches that its leader's purpose is to die. Its leader's purpose is to be a sacrifice. I don't want you to miss this. Jesus came, right? It says Jesus came. Meaning, by saying came there, it meant that he existed before he was ever born. He came into the world. He wasn't born into the world. He came into the world. So he existed before he was ever born. And when he came into the world, Jesus had every right to expect it to be served. As the one who existed before they were actually born, he had every right to expect to be treated special. We spent the last 6 weeks unpacking and trying to create this picture that Mark was giving us, that he is showing you that Jesus is the King. The King. And so he, as the King, he has every right to expect to be served. But the king doesn't exercise that privilege. The king does not leverage the fact that he's the king. He does the exact opposite. Jesus came for the purpose of giving his life as a ransom for many. Jesus, the king, came as a substitution. The substitute sacrifice for me and for you. Jesus came for. Now, that word for that we have in Mark, it's the Greek word that we get our English word. Actually, it means instead of. The word actually translates instead of, in place of. Literally, Jesus the King came in place of or as a substitute for me and for you to give his life as a ransom for many. Now, for me today, for you today, we don't really think too much about that word ransom. It's not really a word that we use very often. We always have it in connection to a kidnapping. right? That's the only context that we have for this word ransom. But in the first century, that was not the case. It had a very different meaning for them, because the word ransom, for those that hear what Jesus has to say then and what would have been written down by Mark back then, actually means to buy freedom for a slave or a prisoner. That word ransom, that's actually what it means, to buy freedom for a slave or a prisoner. See, what would happen is the ransomer would make a sacrificial payment. They would have to make a sacrificial payment that would match the value of the one that they were trying to purchase the freedom for. Or they would make a sacrificial payment that would be big enough and great enough that it would pay the debt of the slave or the prisoner. And so it would buy their freedom. And the ransomer, again, would do this in order to secure the freedom of him or her. And the bigger the debt, the bigger the payment. The greater the value, the greater the sacrifice. That's just the way it worked. And so what we have here, Jesus talking to his guys, you know, on the side of the road. They're on their way to Jerusalem. He's about to fulfill his purpose. And he's telling his guys, I came to pay that kind of ransom for you. I came as the substitutionary sacrifice for you. I came instead of you having to experience the penalty of how you've rebelled against God. But the slavery that Jesus is dealing with, it's on a cosmic scale, you know. This is slavery from a cosmic evil on a cosmic scale, meaning that it's going to require a cosmic payment. So, to make a long story short, too late, I know, but to make a long story short, what Jesus is saying to his guys here on the way to Jerusalem, on the side of the road, huddling them up, you know, that one of the last opportunities that he's going to have to really tell these guys what's getting ready to happen. Something that he's done apparently several times already, which, by the way, Mark is a notorious skipper of details. There's not a lot of detail in the Gospel of Mark. And so if Mark includes this three times, Jesus probably said this more than three times, because Mark just doesn't add a lot of detail. And what he says to his guys here is, guys, I will pay the ransom. I'm going to pay the ransom that you couldn't pay. And I'm going to pay the ransom that you couldn't pay for the purpose of securing your freedom, to getting you out of prison, getting you out of slavery. And the ransom that I have to pay, the cosmic payment that I'm going to pay, is my death on a cross. That's what's going to happen. I'm going to be handed over to the Romans, and they're going to crucify me. But the reason I'm doing it is for you, so that you can have something that otherwise you couldn't have, which is freedom. Now, for some of you, for some of us, especially if you kind of grew up in this background, you're sitting there right now and you're like, yeah, that's right. Jesus, that's right. That's what I'm talking about. Jesus paid my death on the cross. He paid my sin debt, right? But others, you may be sitting there like, ah, there's some pushback for you, especially maybe some of you watching online. I guarantee you there's some pushback there, because what I just described, and again, I'm just trying to unpack what Christianity teaches. I'm not asking you to believe it. I'm just unpacking it. And a lot of you are like, man, that sounds an awful lot like the bloodthirsty gods that were worshipped by the ancient peoples. What's the difference? You know? That don't sound all that loving to me. I mean, I'm up here on this stage kind of trying to paint a picture for you that the God that we serve, this God that we're trying to describe, is somehow different. This belief system, Christianity, is somehow different. It has the answers to the questions that you have. And yet, here I am up here on this point, and it sounds an awful lot like the other belief systems that, you know, existed during antiquity. Doesn't sound that different. A God that requires the death of a person? Sacrifice? It sounds a lot like the Roman gods, the Greek gods, the Mayan gods, the Mesopotamian gods. Sounds an awful lot like that. How is this God that you're trying to... I mean, look, I'm not trying to hide the fact. I'm trying to talk you into it to a certain degree. How is this God different from the savage ancient world that was ruled by irritable gods demanding blood human sacrifice? Sounds an awful similar to me. And if that's you, I get it. I get it. I hear you. I have wondered that myself. I've thought about that too. But that's not what's going on here. It's not at all. And here's why. In fact, you might have to say, if God is really loving, you know, have you ever wondered this? I think it's on this. Yeah. If God is really loving, have you ever wondered this? Why not just forgive everybody? right? Have you ever wondered that? I have. Why did there have to be a ransom anyway? Why did we have to do all of this? Why was this necessary? It seems a little bit arbitrary. I've wondered it. I have. And it's, if you have, that's okay. But see, it misses a huge point. It misses maybe the huge point that separates Christianity from everything else. Because Jesus didn't have to go to the cross and die without the influence of God's love. In fact, Jesus had to die because of that love. It had to be the way it worked. I mean, that's the way love works. It had to be that way because an all life-changing love, which is the love that we're trying to explain that Christianity offers, the answers that Christianity offers, it has to be a substitutionary sacrifice. It has to be. I'm going to try to unpack that better because that's a lot. That's a lot. That's probably a week of its own. But think about it. Let's just kind of sit that down in what we understand today, every single day, what you live with every day. If you love a person, and if that person has it all together, they're good. Everything's together, or at least it looks like it. It seems like it. They're doing everything right. There's really not any major needs that that person has. There's no major problems. It doesn't cost you anything to love that person. It costs you anything. In fact, you may benefit because of the relationship that you have with that person. But think about it. If you try to love someone who has needs, right? If you try to love someone who's in trouble, someone who's persecuted, someone who is emotionally wounded, and we could go on and on, that's going to cost you. That may cost you big time to love that person. Because you know that you can't love that person without taking a hit yourself. You know that. You know that something from you is going to be emptied out and land on them. And you know that some of the mess and some of the junk and some of the baggage from them is probably going to land on you. Right? Y'all know this. You live this. You're thinking about the relationship right now. And you may want to duck and run. Everything inside of you may say, get out of here. Because you know that that type of relationship is grueling, it is exhausting, it's no fun. But you know that the only way that person has any chance of filling up emotionally is if someone loves them. It's the only chance they have. You know that the only way for them to experience that love is to allow you to be a little bit emotionally drained of what you have. And so some of your fullness is going to have to go on them, and to some degree, you're going to have to empty out. And some of their mess is going to come on you. Because you know, if you cut and run, you know right now they're going to sink. They're not going to make it. You know that. You're thinking about it right now. You're thinking about that relationship right now. Now, you're thinking on a really kind of a really, really messy plane. And so I'm going to bring that down to a little more common idea here in just a second. But you're thinking about your relationship with your brother right now. I know you are. I know you are. You're thinking about your mom's relationship with your sister right now. Maybe you're thinking about your relationship with your child, your grandchild, a friend. And you know that the only way to love them is through some type of a substitutionary sacrifice. You know that. You know that you have to choose to give from your fullness and empty yourself and very possibly get some of their pain and their problems in return. You know that. And again, right now, man, our thoughts immediately go to kind of some of those really nasty, messy things. And hey, yeah, they're out there. And absolutely, that is true. But this is the parent-child relationship. This is the parent-child relationship. This is how it works. This is what every parent does for their infant when that child can't do anything for themselves. They can't do anything for you. And it's exhausting. It is exhausting. In fact, some of you, the parents right now, those of you who don't have kids right now, those are the parents that have infant children right now, you didn't even hear me say that because you're asleep. You are exhausted. You're done. You checked out as soon as the lights went dark. You come to church and give your kid to the nursery so that you can go, oh, please make it be a long message this morning. I need a break, right? And that's okay. We are happy to do that because that's a substitutionary sacrifice. We're happy to do it. Those of you that are, you just woke up like, is he talking about us? Yes, I am. I'm talking about you. That is what it's like having kids. Infants, you know. You raise them, you teach them, you train them, everything from eating, going to the bathroom, you bathe them, you read to them, you do all of the things that are necessary. Because you know, as a parent, that they are physically and emotionally needy. They are vulnerable. They are dependent upon you. And if you have a parent that doesn't do this, will the child grow up physically? Yes. More than likely. Through a lot of the other institutions and things that we have available, whether it be school lunches, whatever, yeah, they'll grow up physically. But they probably will not grow up emotionally. They'll stay needy. They'll stay vulnerable. They'll stay dependent. And so here's the point. Either the parent makes the sacrifice that's necessary for that out of love, or the child's going to have to make the sacrifice later. Somebody's going to have to make it. Either the parent suffers temporarily in a redemptive way for the child, or that child is going to suffer tragically in a wasteful and destructive way. So at least partially, mom, dad, it's up to you. Because, again, to circle all the way back, stay with me. All real life-changing love is a substitutionary sacrifice. And you know this from your own experience. You've lived this your entire life. If you've got kids, you've lived it on both sides. Anyone who has ever done anything significant for you or for me to make a difference for you, a parent, a teacher, a mentor, a friend, a spouse, a coach, they sacrificed for you in some way. They gave of themselves for you. They stepped in and they accepted some of the hardship so you wouldn't be hit yourself. So really, Christianity, this belief system, God, and the way all this pieces together, really, it makes perfect sense. It really fits in perfectly with everything that we just know is true. You don't think about it with your kids. It's the same thing. We live this every day. This is the way it works. And the God that we're talking about, the God that we're trying to just kind of describe as best we can, is so much more loving than you or I will ever be. Loving in a perfect, absolutely vulnerable way, because he doesn't need me. He don't need me. I say, well, I don't need my kids. I don't know. This God we're talking about is loving us in ways that we can't imagine. Because this is the God that came into the world to deal with the ultimate evil and the ultimate sin. And yes, would have to make the ultimate substitutionary sacrifice for you. Why? Love. Love. Even for me, as messed up as I am, and you don't know my story and I don't know your story, so maybe you can say the same thing. Maybe as messed up as you are. He did it for me because God can't just ignore evil. We know that. We know we can't just ignore evil. We know that evil cannot be removed or healed by someone just saying, forget about it. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. It's not the way it works. That's not the way it works. We say it, but it's not the way it works. Because we all know that it's got to be paid for. And paying for it, dealing with it, we know it's going to be costly. So if we know this to be true in our everyday life, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 and one quarter days a year, if we know that, and if we live that, and we experience that, and we don't question that in our day-to-day lives, why in the world should we expect God to just ignore it? He can't ignore evil. See, actually, that makes no sense. It makes the opposite. Meaning the debt had to be paid. It had to be paid. And since that's the case, since the debt had to be paid, and you couldn't pay it, then it makes the God that I'm trying to explain to you all the more loving. Because he was willing to die in order for that debt to be paid. He came and gave his life as a ransom for many. And I know we keep making this statement, and And maybe we overstate it, but it's true. This is where the God of the Bible is different. Again, I'm not asking you to believe it. I'm just telling you this is the way it works. Whether you agree or not, this is the way Christianity, this is the theology of Christianity. This is where the God of the patriarchs, the God of Israel, this is where Jesus, this is where God of Christianity is radically different from all of the primitive gods that came before and all of the belief systems that have come since. This is the difference. See, the ancients understood very, very well the ideas of the wrath of God. They understood very, very good, very, very well the ideas of the justice of God. They didn't argue with that. They understood the concept of debt and punishment. They just had absolutely no idea that it was going to be God himself that would come to pay the price. Homer, this is not that Homer, but like historically Homer, the author of the Iliad and the Odyssey, you know, if you're lit or whatever, he had no concept. He had concept of God's wrath and his anger and his justice. And he had that, sure. He had no concept of God's grace and God's love. The disciples didn't have it. They didn't understand that the only way to redeem us, the only way to come in substitution for us, to get us out of slavery, was for Jesus to give his life as a ransom for us. They didn't understand that. They knew that God just couldn't say, I forgive everybody. He could say, let there be light. He could say, let there be plants and animals. Let there be sun, moon, and stars. But he couldn't say, let there just be forgiveness. Because that's not how forgiveness works. And while God could create the world in an instant, beautiful process, the process of recreating the world and redeeming the world on the cross was not a beautiful process. It was a horrible process. We're going to talk about a lot more in the next few weeks. But that's how it works. Of course it should be. Because love that really changes things, right? Love that really makes the difference. Love that you can really sink your teeth into. It's a substitutionary sacrifice. Always. Which is why Jesus told his disciples, I came to give my life as a ransom for you. And real quick, got to go fast. One of the things, you know, we think the disciples were starting to understand this, right? Like, yeah, okay, God, Jesus, we get it. We get it. He's been telling them this. Mark said one time he said it very plainly to them. They weren't getting it. In fact, this is immediately following that. James and John, right? The sons of Zebedee, they go up to Jesus. They kind of, after this little powwow, they kind of get Jesus off to the side. They say, teacher, will you do anything we ask? That's a great way to start a prayer. That's, yes, Jesus, anything, right? You good? We good? Awesome. Jesus says, okay, what do you want me to do? They reply, well, here's what we need you to do, Jesus. When you sit on your glorious throne, right? When you're in your moment of great glory, we want to sit in the places of honor on your right and your left. Jesus, when you come into your glory, you are the king on your throne, which, by the way, we're pretty sure that's getting ready to happen. We think that this whole process is leading up to what's getting ready to happen in Jerusalem. We just know it. We're feeling it. When that happens, Jesus, we want to be your prime minister and your chief of staff. Sound good? Two thumbs up. What do you think? Now, before following this any further, I just want to point out the irony. Have you ever thought about the irony of what James and John asked for? Because think about it. What is the moment of the greatest glorifying act that Jesus gives on this earth? Greatest act of glory, where man, Jesus shows the glory of God's justice and the glory of God's love for humanity. Where's it at? It's on the cross, right? Think about it. When Jesus is on the cross, at that moment of his greatest glory, which is what James and John were asking about, there are two people on his right and his left, right? There's one on his left, there's one on his right. They're being crucified. They're criminals. Which honestly makes what Jesus says next make total sense. He says, you have no idea what you're asking. You don't get it. Are you able to drink from the bitter cup of suffering that I'm about to drink from? Anytime in Hebrew, it talks about a cup that is almost always a metaphor for God's wrath and God's judgment against evil. Almost always. Are you able to do this? Are you able to be baptized with the baptism that I'm getting ready to be baptized with? Fellas, hey, you have no idea what you're asking for. because I'm about to be completely and fully immersed in this overwhelming experience that you just can't imagine. I'm getting ready to pay the ransom, and I'm going to completely drink that cup dry. I'm going to take all of the judgment of all humanity, and I'm going to free you from the condemnation. John, can you handle that? Big James, what about you, buddy? You handle that? They don't get it. They say, yeah, sure, we got it. We're able. We can handle this. And then Jesus said, well, you're going to drink from my bitter cup and be baptized with my baptism of suffering. That's going to happen. You don't know it yet, but it's coming for you. But I have no right to say who's going to sit on the left and the right for me. And then the other disciples hear this. They get really mad, understandably. I probably would have too. And when I read this, I think to myself, how can these idiots keep missing it? How can these fools keep missing what seems to be so obvious? I mean, here Jesus is, right? Here Jesus is. He's told them this. Again, he's made it very, very clear why he came and all of these things. How can they keep missing it? But really and truly, the correct response is, how do we keep missing it? What are we missing? What am I missing now? Because think about it. And this is kind of where we're wanting to land this morning. When or if we ever truly realize the magnitude of the cross and the magnitude of that substitutionary sacrifice, really, really allow that understanding to permeate our thinking, you're never going to be anything except for humble. You can't be. When we truly at our core grasp the truth of the cross and the implications of the cross for us, you can't be arrogant. You just can't be. You can't be arrogant toward James and John. You can't be arrogant toward others. You can't be arrogant toward anyone. So I guess what I'm asking is this. If we believe the cross, the truth of the cross, if you believe that, and if you believe the message and the implications for you and what it means, he came to pay your ransom and to set you free, in spite of the fact of all of the junk that you brought into this room, and I did too, why do we worry? I mean, really, worry at its core is arrogance, isn't it? Think about it. Worry assumes I know the way that my life should be going and God's not getting it right. That's worry. Worry declares, I'm afraid he's not going to get it right, and I got to step in. That's worry. Worry's human. That's a human condition. Worry's arrogance. Humility. Humility. Humility is relax. God's got it. This is going to go the way he planned. Humility allows you to laugh at yourself. Humility allows you to be self-critical, not others critical. Humility is not intuitive. It's not. Humility is not something that you were born with. Humility is something that only the truth of the cross and really embracing the truth of the cross and the implications of the cross, humility is, that's what brings humility. When you realize you're forgiven. Humility. Humility is happiness. Humility is purpose. Humility is contentment. When you realize the Creator God of the universe loved me enough, in spite of anything I've done, to die for me in my place as a substitutionary sacrifice, allowing all of my junk and my mess to get on him. Humility is happiness. Very quickly, back to the account. Jesus sees they don't get it. He gets them together one more time. It's like the final, okay. Jesus calls them together. He says, you know the rulers of this world. You know how this works. They lord it over the people, right? The people with the power lord it over the little peons like me, and the officials flaunt all of their authority for the people that are under them. You know how it works, right? That's what Jesus is saying to his guys. And they understand this. This is the world that they live in. They know, and you still know, that everyone is busy trying to get their way. And you know that the more power and authority and the more position and the more this and that and the relationships and the connections that you have, the more likely your chances are of getting your way. That's how the world works. You know that the wealthy and the powerful enjoy this. Might makes right. You know that. It's the way the world works. I have the power, I get my way. I have the wealth, I get my way. I have the connections, I get my way. And Jesus is saying, guys, y'all know that's how it works. And I bet James and John, I bet when Jesus has got them together, they probably like over in the back, you know, like, we know that's exactly the way it works. And that's the reason when you're sitting on the throne, we want to be on your right and on your left, because that's what we want too. We want some authority. We've been getting told what to do our whole lives. We want to be in charge. And then Jesus burst their bubble. Maybe he burst your bubble. Again, I've been just trying to tell you, to describe Christianity to you, right? This is the way it works. You don't have to believe. Well, now I'm going to, up to this point, it's like, yeah, that sounds great. Now I'm going to burst your bubble. Because this is also what Jesus taught. He says, not so with you. It's going to be different. It's not the way it works. Whoever wants to be a leader among you, they got to be your servant. Whoever wants to be first among you, got to be a slave to everyone else. What we have here is actually an old covenant new covenant version of an old covenant principle. In Jeremiah chapter 29:11, okay? Not 29:11. Gosh, that is so that is so ingrained in my brain. Sorry about that. Just in Jeremiah chapter 29. It's actually, I think, in verse 9, verse 7. The Israelites have been taken into captivity in Babylon. They're in trouble. And then God tells them, here's how you act while you were enslaved. Here's how I want you to act. It's in Jeremiah 29:7. He says, I want you to work for the peace and the prosperity of the city where I sent you into exile. That's what I want you to do. Pray to the Lord for it, for its welfare will determine your welfare. I want you to pray for them. Pray for your captors. I want you to pray that I will bless them and I will prosper them. Israel, I want you to seek their prosperity. I want you to serve your neighbors, serve your captors, serve your enemies. Love them, pray for them, seek their peace, and through your service, you too will prosper. See, God's telling his people that the path to gaining influence is not through power and control. That's the world's way. That makes sense. But that changes nothing. Society, culture, the hearts and minds of people, that's what they expect to see every day, because that's the human condition. And even though it makes the most sense, Jesus is saying to his guys on the way to Jerusalem, he's saying, with you, it's got to be different, because I'm giving you a brand new way to live, a brand new way to operate. And this is from God. And the approach that I'm giving you says for you to be so sacrificially loving that the people around you who don't even believe like you, may not even like you, soon they'll be unable to imagine the place without you. Is that on the screen? Yes, good. This approach that Jesus says and that God had already talked about in the Old Covenant says that you are so sacrificially loving to people that the people that don't even believe like you, they're not going to be able to imagine the place without you. And if you do that, if you live that way, they'll start to trust you. They'll start to believe you, because they'll see you're not out for yourself. You're out for them too. So much so that they might begin to look up to you, because your service and your love and your humility for them is so attractive. Then you've got influence. Not influence that's taken by you, but influence that's given to you. Because the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve others and to give his life as a ransom for many. So what else would I do? We're right back where we started. Right? Where does happiness lie? Secularism won't do it. Psychology, religion, moralism, all of the things that we've talked about. They won't do it. So what do? Where do you go? You look beyond yourself. It's not about you. You look to Jesus. You look at his example. You look at what he did for you. Think about it. If he is really the ransom and the substitutionary sacrifice for your sins, if that's true, and I believe it is, I hope you do, but think about it. If he really did pay the penalty, the debt for your sin by his death on the cross, and if that is true, if he has proven to our insecure little frightened hearts that he is worth, that we are actually worth everything to him because he's willing to do that, and so therefore my value is exponentially greater than I ever understood, then in him and in that relationship, I've got everything I need. And I can be happy. You can be happy. That's grace. So, do you want to be happy? That's what you're looking for. that satisfaction, that contentment, that laying your head on your pillow at the end of the day and going, ah, okay. Jesus loves you. He loves you enough to ransom himself for you. We don't need people to feel better about themselves. We want you to resemble the one who did so much for you. We just want to bring him to light. And the only thing that's going to get that done is the good news, the gospel. The only thing that gives you the motivation for the type of unselfish living that we are talking about in this series, the only thing is the fact that Jesus loved you enough to go to the cross for you in your place to get you out of prison. Jesus is our example. Jesus is our why. That is your ticket to happiness. Let's pray. God, I am the first to admit that I am a roller coaster of emotion most of the time. I'm on top of the world one minute, I'm in the basement the next. I am just so inconsistent with the way I think about myself, the way that I think about others, the way that I think about the world that we experience every day. But God, I do believe that you loved me enough to come to this earth to die in my place as a substitutionary sacrifice. So my value is so much greater than I could ever understand. And my purpose is so much greater than anything that I could ever understand. So God, help us as we go into our week to remember what Paul said, what he wrote. That we love others, we serve others, we are kind to others. Not because it's natural and not because it's what we necessarily even want to do. We do it. Jesus did it for us. It's in his name that we ask these things.